Welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. For the next hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Chris Chamberlain Churchill, a professor in the astronomy department at NMSU. Dr. Churchill, thanks so much for joining us again. This is we had you on about a month ago when you were a presenter for the Academy for Learning and Retirement, and that was one of those interviews where we got to the end of the half hour and we had just barely scratched the surface on all of the interesting things that they're talking about, that are worth talking about with space now, which is, it hasn't been like that for a long time, it seems like.
Yeah, we've had a little bit of a dry spell here, about half a century, actually.
I think that's right. But now all of a sudden. So let me start with asking the space race of today. We all kind of grew up with the space, or I did at least, the space race of the 60s and 50s and 70s, where it was us against Russia. Mm-hmm. And they put up Sputnik, and then we had to respond. Now it's us and China, it seems like. But my question is the underpinning of this whole thing. So in 1969, we go to the moon. We get there first. We take an American flag. We plant the flag on the surface of the moon. Now, that is following hundreds of years of tradition of sailors and explorers planting their flag in a new territory as if nobody else had ever lived there before, and then claiming it to be their own.
Yeah.
Are they parallels? I mean, just because we plant a flag, does that mean we get to claim the moon?
So for me, this is the million-dollar question, because the short answer is no. But I think the long answer, in practice, we might repeat some of our behaviors of the sea race. So in 1967, in anticipation of Apollo, an international body got together and put together what's called the Space Treaty of 1967.
Okay.
And basically it was, space is to be used for all humans for peaceful purposes, no nuclear explosions, and no militarization, and no ownership. Okay. And so that's very different directive than, say, what happened during the sea race, which it was called the Doctrine of Discovery. You plant the flag, you own it.
Right.
Now, if you'll allow me just a short story.
Please.
There was this guy in Rome, the Pope, and he was the figure of power. Thank you. He was the figure of power higher than kings. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so kings would defer to him. He made a treaty that split the world in two between two rival powers, Portugal and Spain, and it's called the Treaty of Tordesillas. And that worked for Portugal and Spain while they were the two seafaring powers. But Britain got involved, French got involved, France got involved, and the Dutch got involved, the Netherlands. And they basically started the First World War, and they ignored the Pope. And here's the problem. The Pope had no means to enforce mm-hmm. the treaty. And there was too much power amongst the other three nations that Spain and Portugal could not enforce the treaty. Okay. So bottom line was, we adopted some other doctrines. One was called terra nullius, meaning nobody's lands. The other one was diminished rights and superiority of law, which is to say anybody who came there could take control if they had the will to do so. And it really became might makes right.
Right.
And lands were wrestled from other countries. I hate to say it, but I haven't seen what I would call an evolution in the human condition of human culture. Okay? And so it's a little bit of a dark view, but I feel that people will talk about these laws. There's about five space treaties now. All of them are going to be impossible, nearly impossible to enforce. And then there's even something called the Artemis Accords, led by the United States, signed by many, many nations, not China, not Russia. Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, my personal feeling is that when we get out there, things might evolve in the sort of wild, wild west age of discovery. That's a euphemism and a positive light for the beginnings of imperialism and colonialism.
Right, right.
And I can see that playing out in the solar system. And one additional dimension to that is privateers. We had privateers in
Elon
those days.
Musk.
Elon Musk. But I'm also thinking in terms of sort of the swashbuckling Han Solo types.
Okay.
You know, and we had those all throughout history, going all the way back to the Bronze Age on the seas. Mm. And nations would hire these privateers to disrupt the trade and flow of nations that had claimed certain lands. There's a lot of lawlessness, and I don't see that there's going to be a body that can enforce it. However, just to put a period on what I've been saying, there are things that are developing that are different, such as the Space Force of the United States. That's another story that has some parallelisms and some differences from the sea race.
Right.
What does the Space Force even do?
So I was looking at their website the other day, and they have a directive that is that their directive is to protect the assets of the United States in space. And they even directly mention China as a competitor, and that China is viewed as an aggressor that is trying to undermine and sabotage American efforts. And so they're there to do reconnaissance on those and spycraft and to circumvent them.
Isn't China sort of ahead of the U.S. right now in terms of lunar exploration?
I'm going to give you a big fat yes on that.
See, and that surprises me because we just don't hear, the news doesn't cover that at all.
No, they don't. But if you were to ask me also the question, who's going to get there first? I'm sorry. I'm going to say it's going to be China. They are doing a very systematic step-by-step approach. They're doing basically what we did in the 60s. Step A, step B, step C, step D. And they have done everything. They have 7 missions that have gone to the moon, 5 have landed, 2 had rovers, and 2 have brought back samples. So they've done everything you need to do to land a person on the moon, except have a spacecraft that's what you would call human-rated. They have a human-rated command module that they've tested, and they are in the process now of testing their landing, lunar landing. And it's a little bit more like Apollo. It's a small craft to bring down 2 Tychonauts. They call them Tychonauts. They're saying by 2030. But they are moving in such a straight line path of progress that they may make it earlier, and they're being conservative. And they're on track. There's no showstoppers. Let's put it that way. The United States has, I think, decided on a mode to get to the back to the moon that is fraught with the potential of failure. And it relies heavily on Elon Musk's Starship. Now, I was shocked when I learned that the Starship can't get to the moon from Earth without being refueled. And in fact, they can only take up so much fuel on a second Starship when they refuel in orbit that it takes, get this, 10 launches to prepare one Starship, 10 refueling launches to prepare one Starship to go to the moon. This is an unproven vehicle. I mean, it did have just a test a couple days ago. It was a resounding success, that test. But the refueling in orbit, I believe, is something that has never been tried.
Right.
So, So that's how I feel about it.
Other than just, patriotic pride, what difference does it make?
Okay, so I anticipated this question because it's really an important question. I mean, really a very important question. So I'm going to say to you, okay, why am I speaking in English right now? Why does most of the Americas speak Spanish and some Portuguese, and certain areas in Canada speak French, or in the South, Louisiana, have French culture integrated into them? That's why it's important, because who gets there first will establish culture. Okay. And human culture will then evolve in this way. And if it plays out like the Americas did, where you have several wars and battles that decide who gets sovereignty in the end, and whose language and whose religion and whose economic model will be in place, that could happen in the solar system. And if I can add one more thing, if you can imagine going back in time to, say, the year 1400, really before the sea race happened, which really kicked up in the late 1400s, standing on the coastline of, say, Portugal, and looking out at the sea. And at that point, the world was not fathomed globally to people. So they didn't know what was out there. And they saw a big blue nothing that went nowhere, or went somewhere but had no clue, and it was filled with just a void of no knowledge. You know, like you can't even imagine it. I think that a lot of people look in the sky today and somewhat feel that way. You know, it's like, oh, there's so much space between the planets. It takes, 6 months to go to Mars, and, it's black and it's empty and you can't breathe. And,
infinity.
And then, outside the solar system, that's where the brain breaks down, because it goes forever. But I think that somebody 200 years from now, certainly 500 years from now, will feel the same way that we do when we look out at the oceans and understand all of those trade routes and all of that activity, and the fact that it is a superhighway to global connectivity. That will be the same thing in space. I really, truly believe that. And we're just at that stage where our minds aren't ready.
Obviously we did it, and we can't undo it, but it seems like China is very disciplined and moving in one direction with everybody on board.
Highly focused.
The same place. Yeah. And we've got 10 different people working on, 10 different things, and the government really doesn't seem to be controlling or organizing any of it.
For anybody who's interested in the story of why it took 50 years, if it's okay for me to mention a documentary film.
Sure.
It's called Fight for Space. It's a documentary film interviewing many astronauts and various space officials throughout the history. And the short of it is that with a 4-year cycle for the White House and short cycles for the individuals in Congress, and the fact that the administrator for NASA is an appointed individual from the administration, you've got people switching in, switching out, switching out, switching in. And you really just have a perfect storm of, this NASA administrator wants to do A, but the Congress won't fund A. They want to do B, so they end up doing C. And then before they get C off the ground, they want to do D. Yep. That's what it's been. And so we have this thing where every time NASA tells us to get excited, we're going to do it. We're boy who cried wolf. And I think that people still are jaded by that, even with the ongoing Artemis
missions. Yeah, the success of that mission.
Yeah,
right.
Like, okay, great. But when are we going to land? Or when are we going to do something more than just footsteps and flags?
Well, doesn't that perhaps speak to the sort of superiority in terms of arranging space exploration of someplace like China that makes it a government priority, completely controlled by the government, and doesn't attempt to farm out parts of it to the private sector or make its funding consequent on, you know, Democratic Republic type
debates.
Yeah. Or, you know, votes in the legislature.
Right. Instead of we have people that are making votes so that they're playing to the next election. They're playing politics. It's what I think you're saying. And so the answer, I think, along those lines is that there's a lot to be said for having a state system that is focused and stable like that. And, Neil deGrasse Tyson has actually argued that the government of the United States should create a body of future culture, future science, futurists that are a body that doesn't change with time and that are outside the political system. But anyway, the fact of the matter is I do believe the United States is a little bit schizophrenic in this way. You mentioned that you're trying to get private industry, and so you're trying to retool NASA at the same time by taking the development of rockets away from government and putting into contractors. This is just really a fancy way of trying to get money back into different states and into different economies, and it's part of the political game. Okay. But you also want to develop the private sector because the model is, and this is to get back to your question too, is that the governments, if you look at the history of settling frontiers, governments play that initial role where they quantify the unknowns. There's this massive investment. You can think of like Lewis and Clark as a moonshot, okay, to go out into across the United States. And so you quantify those unknowns, and then eventually you get private industry involved. So how did you open up the West? The government worked with railroads, and they worked together, and they built the Transcontinental Railroad, and that then opened up the frontier. And then you had to do something else. You had to have a policy, like the Homestead Act and things like that. So this is more of the model that people are expecting to happen in space as well. Maybe not private ownership, but certainly corporate ownership and national ownership. I think in the end there will be claims to land on the surface of some of these bodies. So that's to your question. I think that's the reason why China will beat us. Mm-hmm. And they will continue the momentum after they, people think, oh, the finish line is the first people back on the moon, but that's just the beginning.
Yeah. Excuse me. I guess going back to the original sea explorers, part of that was exploring for the sake of exploration. There you go. But a bigger part of it was looking for wealth. They came here looking for gold.
So I have a little snap phrase for this is God, gold, and glory.
Yes.
That's what that was all about. Yes. Maybe not in that
spreading
order.
Spreading their religion.
Spread the religion. Very important.
Yes.
And in fact, part of the doctrines that I was talking about was that they actually said in the doctrines, non-Christians, that Christians had the right to take the land. And that there was also the right of the governments were more sophisticated, and therefore they would overwrite the laws that were there. I forgot where I was going to go with that.
Well, let me just finish my question.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Where is the gold in space?
Because
we know there aren't people to convert.
Rare earth minerals.
You said it. Okay. There is more gold on one asteroid, of which there are billions out there. There's more gold on one asteroid than there is that you can extract cost effective on the planet. Period.
Okay.
One.
Did not know that.
Titanium group. Metals, things like that. You want to build infrastructure of enormity, like an O'Neill space station, Gerard K. O'Neill proposed these big space stations, you're going to have to mine all of these precious metals. So the value of asteroids are incredible. We're talking trillions of dollars, just one asteroid, in terms of some of them have water on them. Now, the water is, of course, drinkable. It can be split for oxygen and hydrogen, which generates power, and then the hydrogen can be used as a fuel. So there's trillions of dollars in that market. And then you've got the iron group asteroids, and you can mine nickel and all these other metals out of that. So the bottom line is there's three major areas of elements on the periodic table that are involved in that have markets, what we would call off-planet resources. The moon as well. Okay, and so that's one of the aspects of why China and the United States, there's a little bit of a moon rush here, and that is that there is tritium and helium-3. And helium-3, for example, is very important for national security, for detecting radiation. And tritium is a fuel for nuclear fusion, which is a clean energy. I mean, you could put a teaspoon of water, you could, you know, power a city for 50 years or even more. It's incredible energy source. It's what powers the sun. But if we can master fusion, the moon is a tritium source. There are companies already building the infrastructure to mine these things and are expecting to be able to bring tritium back from the moon, say, in the next decade. And, I think people, it's so below the radar. There are so many startup investors in the space business that are ready. They're making themselves ready to go so they can be there first.
To what extent does the idea of, you know, sort of space industry like lunar mining or asteroid mining depend on people who are hired to do mining or to do stuff on the moon, people who are not like investors but actual workers, laborers?
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, we're talking like the Industrial Revolution all over again. And guess what? The conditions for those workers were horrific at first because there weren't any laws in place. We're just going to watch, I believe, the whole thing repeat itself. Will these companies respect terrestrial laws mm-hmm. when they're off world? And probably if they can squeeze more profit by pushing that limit, they will. And then you'll watch the whole thing re-evolve, my humble opinion.
And aren't we kind of seeing that a little bit just with our own space here with satellites? I mean, it seems like we're going to get to a place eventually where somebody's going to have to take some control over that. Or we're just going to, you know, end up with so much space junk floating around up there that it will eventually be a problem, I would think.
Oh, I think that's very true. I think that there's going to have to be regulation on that. And there are apparently some young people that are working on ways to clear out the space junk. Mm-hmm. There's some ideas on that. But I think it's interesting. Like right now, you have Starlink, for example, with Elon Musk and SpaceX, and they're putting up thousands and thousands of satellites. And the astronomers, of course, are horrified because literally our telescopes are seeing streaks go through them, you know, that we never had before. And we're trying to figure out how to use AI to like remove these things from our images and so we can do our science. But in a sense, once you have this, you know, space up there, and it's like in the sea race, it's like whoever gets there first owns it. So these orbital spaces, nobody's selling them yet. It's a commodity. It could be so like, oh, I got to, you know, this certain particular
right,
orbit, you
point.
could sell that, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, but they're not doing that. And so it's right. free right now. And once you take it, you own it. So like once all those Starlink satellites are up there, Elon Musk or SpaceX or whatever, whoever owns that orbital terrain, if you will. And there's no regulation now for that. So yeah, that's got to come, and it's better come soon.
One of the things we haven't touched on yet, and I think, you know, especially when you talk about China, is concerning, and that is the militarization of space. And I assume that when Donald Trump put together Space Force, that's kind of what he was thinking about.
Very much so.
What do you see for the potential future there?
So that's another good question, and kind of maybe a little dark as well.
Yeah, sure. But we're humans. It's human nature.
But we have not really evolved since those days. So one of the thing that was interesting, I'm just going to go back again to the sea race for just a minute. When the Dutch East India Company was created by in the Netherlands, and that was just a series of investors who put together a company, and they campaigned the government to obtain powers to control the territories that they had landed on, and that they could actually form their own military and protect their assets. And of course, there were secrets. And that's really what happened. And the Dutch went around and they unlodged all the Portuguese out of all their ports in the Indies and took over. And they fought on the open seas with the British, who had their own British Indies Company, East Indies Company, and also had their navy under their control of this company. Okay, I don't know if people realize that there was a collaboration between these state-sponsored companies, and they had war powers. They could raise the money for war. They could build the ships for war. So one has to wonder whether that might repeat itself. I'm thinking that the formation of something like the Space Force might circumvent repeating that, where you have corporations who have war-making powers granted by sovereign states. It'd be hard to imagine that again. But if you've got China and the United States out there, and there's one area of the moon which is highly valuable, i.e. the South Pole, because it has a lot of permafrost water on it, and it is the number one target right now. Both China and the U.S. are planning on putting permanent moon bases with humans on there. In fact, NASA just made an announcement this week about that more. But that is going to be a contention. You know, who gets there first? Who has the rights to it? I mean, and what's to stop people from saying might makes right?
Nothing.
That's the end of it, right?
If history is any indication, nothing. We are at the bottom of the hour, so I need to let people know you're listening to KTALLP 101.5 FM in Las Cruces, and we're talking with Dr. Chris Churchill, astronomy professor at the University of New Mexico.
New Mexico State University.
Oh, my goodness. How do I get that wrong?
I just pulled my hair out.
Yes. My apologies to all the Aggies. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Jamie, thank you so much for correcting that.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
If the United States ought to be more committed to space exploration, what do you make of the decision to, like, pretty much get rid of the planetary science division at JPL?
There are so many broken hearts that you know. Okay, so I don't understand and can't say that I understand the administration's sort of schizophrenic approach to this. It's like, oh, we want to be great. We want to be the best, and, you know, blah, 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 and then cut some of the things that really define what makes a great society great. So I think it's tragic. NASA is facing another tremendous budget cut. And so is the National Science Foundation. There's just been a directive put out that academics are not supposed to collaborate with foreign professors. I don't understand this. I mean, this is going so backwards from the spirit of growing human culture and human knowledge. There's so much to say about it.
It's not really consonant, is it, with the idea of the United States leading?
It is not.
Yeah.
In fact, I love this country that I grew up in. I'm proud of many things about it. I understand the contradictions that have been built into it through time, at least intellectually. But I fear that as a great experiment that it's been, that it's facing some of its greatest challenges now. And I hope it's just a phase.
It's kind of a shame. I mean, Artemis was very exciting.
Yes, it was.
And as somebody who is a member of Generation X, I was kind of holding my breath the whole time that the ship was coming back into orbit and you know, moving down towards the Earth, because I thought, all right, I saw the Challenger explosion and I heard about Columbia, and, you know, I just have like trauma from those events. And it was nice to see such a happy culmination, and also to see the sort of moon joy that a lot of young people had who had not been alive for any of that stuff.
You know, Jamie, I'm glad you brought the conversation back around to that, because there was a euphoria, and there, you know, it's more brief-lived today in this modern world than it was back in the 60s, because A, that was the first time, and B, we had never seen a photograph taken by a human of the Earth, and it's not a robot. Now today, we see so many amazingly high-resolution, beautiful photographs of the Earth, the Moon, and the planets, and we've become accustomed to them, so they don't have the shock value. But with Artemis, we know that people took those pictures. Yeah. And those people, they had feelings, and they brought those feelings home, and they are life-altering, life-changing feelings, enough to change what you might call your identity in your relationship to the planet. And that's powerful. So there is a tremendous amount of positive culture that can come out of sending humans that has nothing to do with corporate greed or turning a dollar or having sovereign rights over some territory. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the term. It's called the overview effect. So it's a thing. And there's a gentleman by the name of Frank White who wrote a book in the 80s called The Overview Effect. And he has now something online called the Overview Institute. And it's all about interviewing astronauts who have seen the planet from space and making a log of this positive experience. And of course, he's been actively involved with the four Artemis astronauts who had a tremendous overview euphoria, if you will. And that is just spectacular. More of it, bring more of that home. And, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson has said that, you know, if you're doing these kinds of things, especially for exploration and discovery, you are birthing a whole new generation of interested, curious people who understand what, if they want to partake in it, how they can and how to get involved, which is, you know, engage in engineering and science and math, because these are people that birth these types of things, or, you know, learn how to fly a spacecraft or become an astronaut. You won't need to have special government programs like STEM programs to convince people. Maybe you should think about science. Maybe you could do something in that, because they can't imagine what to do with it. Whereas I saw Neil Armstrong walk on the moon at the age of 7. I saw the movie 2001 when I was 10.
Right,
and I was like, I know what I want to do with my life, and I understand where I'm going with it. There are so many people from that generation, our age,
yes,
that have become and this is a term I'm borrowing from Rick Tomlinson, the orphans of Apollo. We just were left, we're the generation who fell in the hole.
Well, and I think, you know, Jamie's point about Challenger, I remember that
PTSD.
Day.
PTSD.
Yes, I still remember that day vividly because we had reached the point, I think, as a country and as a society where we were taking that stuff for granted. They go up, they come back down. Yeah. It's great. It's wonderful. It's almost a little bit boring because we're so used to it being successful every single time. And you're pulling your hair out.
No, I am, because it happened in Apollo, too. I mean, even
Yes, you're right.
Apollo 11, of course, was tremendous, but nobody watched Apollo 13 until it became a disaster show.
Which one burned up on the launch pad?
It was Apollo 1.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that happened in January of 1967.
Yeah. And I just think that people soured. They saw that and they soured on the whole thing.
Or became, I think, somewhat disinterested, as you hinted to, and a little bit of, you know, when Artemis flew up, we had PTSD too. My wife and I, we both were watching that holding our breath, and she cried from the release of the relief of the happiness of that. Yes. And but the thing about the space shuttle that it kept going up and kept going up, and then it was going to the space station and back and forth. You could go see the interviews that people would be interviewed on the street. What's NASA doing? I don't know.
Right.
What do we use the space station for? I don't know. And so that's the disconnect. And it could be that, you know, if some economies start to develop and people start to understand that metals are being brought back to Earth and they're, you know, affecting economies, then they get it. I also wanted to speak to the space shuttle program briefly, just, you know, in terms of Challenger and Columbia. So the space shuttle was really an amazing engineering feat, and I do not want to diminish the accomplishments of that program at all. But that vehicle did, in a sense, kill more astronauts than any other vehicle that has flown. And that was not necessarily any one person's fault. What it was really was a design compromise. And so the space shuttle was designed very differently so that all the fuel and the rockets were below the cabin. They cut so much money from that program. They had to keep going back to the drawing board, keep redesigning, keep compromising. They finally got those two big solid boosters, and those stretched all the way up to the cabin crew. Plus, they had fuel right under the belly where the crew cabin was. And it turned out to be a very dangerous design and had flaws. So in the sense that was a tremendous, exciting program in the early 80s. But when Challenger happened, it really did shock people that this is a dangerous business. And I wanted also not for the general public to be concerned about the fact that lives are on the line here. This is big stuff. It's where super science meets dreams, you know. But if the politicians would understand that they had an impact here, that by not allowing the scientists and engineer to tell them how to do it, but cutting the money, so they had to compromise and retool everything, that led to those two disasters.
Right.
And
Well, and as you know, once again, as we compare ourselves to China, that's obviously one of our big weaknesses.
It's part of what's baked into our system.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you think it was an error for them to get a school teacher to be aboard that particular flight?
That's a question for the ages.
Yeah.
Short answer is I'm glad they were trying to do that because I think it really would inspire. So, I mean, it did inspire them until they all got PTSD from the disaster. It was a tremendous success up to that very instant in time, 70 seconds in.
Well, if their goal was to get everybody watching the launch, they accomplished
they
that.
They sure did that, right. And NASA was, you know, you were mentioning that people lose interest, you know, stuff like that. So it's like, okay, how can we drum up interest? So that, you know, it was really sort of from a cynical point of view, a PR stunt. But it does, those PR stunts can have real positive butterfly effects. That was just a perfect storm.
Yeah. I wanted, you know, we got about 15 minutes left. What are we doing here other than, you know, at NMSU and I wanted to look specifically at the spaceport. What are they doing out there? Is that still just trying to do tourism and take people up to suborbital space, or is there more going on out there that we don't hear about?
There is a lot going on out there, and gosh, I wish I could speak intelligently to it. I read something about a month ago, and all I can say, but I can't remember everything I read because I was shocked. I was like, this is going on. That is going on. This company has moved in. And, you know, so you have these various companies that are out there that are testing methods, you know, cheap access to space and things like that. And so the spaceport has become a sort of little mini, you know, cosmodrome of think tank of people. And they are out there doing real work and they're making real progress. The most high profile vendor out there, a private company, of course, is Virgin Galactic, and they've sort of put a pause on things for a little while. Meanwhile, I think Blue Origin is still sending some people up, and
is that a viable the concept of space tourism? What do you think about that?
I think it is a typical thing to do when you have an opportunity like that. And right now it's only something that the very wealthy can attain. And it's interesting that if you listen to Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin talk about why he is developing space tourism, or why he started space tourism as his first business model for Blue Origin, to generate funds. Not to generate funds just to put into people's pockets, but to reinvest and build bigger rockets. And what Jeff Bezos, if you want to know what he really wants, what his long game is he wants to build infrastructure for the next generation. You know, he said Amazon depended upon infrastructure to succeed. That business, it depended upon the mailing system, depended upon the internet, you know, and he said you couldn't build a business like Amazon without the infrastructure. And he said you can't build space economies without infrastructure. So he wants to get involved in building infrastructure. And he says that he's dedicated to doing that so that the next generation can build those economies in the same way that he had the opportunity to build Amazon. And with Virgin Galactic, the goal there actually is to build more space tourism, to use the suborbital flights with the Spaceship One and Spaceship Two and the White Knight to generate funds. And, you know, that company is already private and it's on the market. And he wants to build hotels and take people to the moon and have them be able to have a vacation on the moon. So that's a very different vision.
Yeah, it is.
Sir Richard Branson. Yeah.
But I'm glad to hear that there's more going on at the spaceport than just that, because that's...
Yes, I wish I could give the listeners some details, but I just went in one ear and out the other because there were so many of them.
Right. I'm trying to think. Where do we go from here, I guess, is the question. Do you ever see a point where – I know the whole thing with the space station is we were going to send Russians up there and Americans, and it would be this whole symbolism of the International Space Station, not the United States Space Station.
Right.
Do you ever see a time when – humanity joins together and does this as one, or will we always be competing with each other? And maybe competition's a good thing. I don't know.
If you had asked 20-year-old or 25-year-old Chris this, yeah, I would have been so idealistic. It's, you know, this is the course. This is what humanity is going to do. But, you know, I hate to say that I've become a little more cynical, and that I feel like after World War II that we started on a path that could have slowly evolved in that direction. I feel that we have diverged from that path, and the COVID was an indication of that was not unifying. I mean, when COVID hit,
right,
I really thought to myself, this is it. This is the spark. This is what is going to bring humanity together to work against
unite
a threat
against
and
a
unite against
enemy.
A common threat. Right. But no, what did it do? It divided us, yep, even further. So I'll just stop there.
I think that's fair.
But yeah.
One of the things about the sort of Big Blue Marble idea was that it was supposed to increase people's attraction to or advocacy for the Earth because it's the only planet we have. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like people like Elon Musk, and I'm not a fan, feel like he wants to make sure that there's some alternative to Earth for him and his 15 kids and all of his descendants. And so there isn't the same commitment to the preservation of the planet.
So those are very good points as well. And one of the beautiful things about Apollo is it started a movement like that in the 70s. Neil deGrasse Tyson has a very good lecture where he goes through all of the green legislation, if you will, and I won't go through it, that happened while Apollo was, you know, making a cultural impact. So it's true. I believe that space is being looked at more as an opportunity of exploitation rather than something where humans are going to unify around our little blue marble. And so, you know, Jeff Bezos' rose-colored glass vision is you take all of this industry and all the pollutants and you take them off planet and you allow Earth to recover and heal, and you have a beautiful Earth that's our oasis, and then you use the rest of the solar system. Oh boy, I would love it if that vision came true. But on the other hand, we would be treating those bodies with disrespect, and just because they don't have life on them doesn't mean they deserve to be mined and trashed. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that in the end, humans are just going to follow the path they're on, and it's exploitive. And, you know, move into a new environment, exploit the resources until you have to move on to a new environment.
Voyager that got launched in whatever it was, 1977, with the record and the little doodles of the people.
Right.
Is that still floating around somewhere?
Yes, it's still floating around. It's actually on its trajectory. Now, what's fun about that is that the sun has a solar wind from all the pressure that comes off of it in terms of particles and charged particles, radiation and light. And it's pushed the gas around it out very far and created sort of what they call a heliosphere. That goes out really far. And I can't remember exactly how far, but well beyond the edge of the solar system, well beyond it. And a couple hundred times, I believe. So Voyager has passed through that heliosphere. So there's this big sphere, and then it literally has passed into the galaxy, into the interstellar medium that is no longer influenced by our sun. And so, and it sent data back. It's still sending data back. So that little thing is the little spacecraft that could.
They don't make things like they used to, I guess.
So we haven't asked you yet about the release of documents about I guess we don't call them UFOs anymore. They're
APUs.
Yeah,
or something.
Something like that. But and I was saying earlier that you hear all the time that people say space is so large that it would be hubristic to think that we're the only things here. What's your take on all of that?
So in the end, it is hard to argue that we're alone. There's a lot of great arguments to say, that there's billions. I'm starting to sound like Carl Sagan here.
But I guess the next question, I don't mean to jump
Earth-like
in.
Earth-like planets,
But should we welcome or fear that?
If we fear it, I believe that's mirroring our own shortcomings.
I think that's exactly right. We assume that all of our petty, that whoever comes here, that's what we'll encounter.
Yeah. I mean, there is so much time that passes in the universe that if we aren't the first to have developed a technological civilization and looked up at the stars and asked that question, then people have done it before, and the chances are they're millions of years, tens of millions of years. I mean, the difference between when the dinosaurs were on the planet and we're on the planet, yes. Evolutionary change of if that species has survived that long. So, all bets are off. We have no idea what kind of sensibilities and psychologies that they'll have.
I'm sure they're just going to be here to serve man.
There was a great book I read by Timothy Ferris that said that we would, if some came and they were intelligent and benign, that they would just, we would just end up becoming their pets. Mm. We would admire them so much that we would be like the family dog.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
That was kind of
an
interesting statement.
That doesn't seem like a bad life.
Yeah, that's true. All their needs are met.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I want to talk about that a little bit. So, what about humans reaching out? Can you travel amongst the stars?
Right.
Can we?
Right.
Can we get there if we don't, terminate ourselves somehow? And there are people actively working on this too. Now, we all have our science fiction. We have Star Trek, warp drive, Engage. And we have Star Wars with hyperdrive and whatnot. So can we access the stars? And there are a lot of thoughts on how to do that. And many of them are seriously just economic/engineering challenges. And you have to think about, humans are very ingenious, and engineering challenges sometimes we take care of them pretty handily. I mean, you think about 1903, 120 seconds of flight on the beach, powered flight. 1969, boom, landing on the moon.
Right.
Commercial airlines all around the world within 3 or 4 decades.
Blank
or not. And the plane retooled for war in 1914 to 18. Anyway, the idea of warp drive and faster than light travel is something that people are taking very seriously as an engineering problem now. And why do I say it's an engineering problem now? Because the theory has been worked out. And that is fascinating. A Mexican astronomer by the name of Miguel Alcubierre wrote a paper in the 90s in which he formulated the equations for warp drive. And it was legit. And so people have been continuing to refine that and work on it. And there's a NASA lab run by Dr. White, and it's called Eagle Works. And he has taken this theory and made a micro warp in the lab with a device.
What does that mean?
A device that's about the size of your fist. He has, the idea is that you bend space downward in front of the spacecraft, and you build space up into a hill. So the spacecraft sort of doesn't feel a force, but it just moves toward the downhill, and just in the same way that you drop a pen and it falls on the ground.
Gravity,
okay,
right.
just like that. That's exactly the same principle. And so the idea is that you can get the spaceship to move it faster than light because it's the space. And space can move faster than light. It's weird because Einstein said nothing can move faster than light, but it turns out space can move faster than light and space-time can move, but and the spaceship just gets carried by that through it. So he built one of these little micro warps in the lab, and it was a great breakthrough. And, you know, in my classes, I always say, you know, everybody's like, well, ha ha, what good is that? You know, it's like the size of a micron, you know, we're talking about something that has right. to be, the size of a, the Empire State Building or something. And I say, well, in the 1870s, there was this gentleman by the name of Michael Faraday, who was working in the Cavendish Labs in Cambridge, and he made an electric motor, and it was about the size of your fist, and it was a little wire that hung down from a string, and he was able to run some current through a magnet and around a loop, and he got that little copper wire that was just hanging in the string to go around in a circle.
We have come up to the once again. We had a half hour, that wasn't enough time. Boom. Now we've got an hour. That hasn't been enough time either. Okay. But thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.